When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the CEU Press podcast. Today I'm joined by Matt Quartrup to discuss his new book with CEU Press, The Political Brain, The Emergence of Neuropolitics. The book is part of our new CEU Press Perspective series. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Thank you very much, and I'm very impressed that you can pronounce my name. I can't even do that myself.
Before we dive into discussing the book, I wanted to ask you to introduce yourself to our listeners and also talk about your trajectory of how you became a political scientist interested in neuroscience.
Yes, so my trajectory is probably a relatively unusual one. I started my life studying neuroscience, and I found that moderately interesting, and it gave me a good grounding, but I was really interested in politics. So when I had studied that, started my career in biology for a while, I shifted to political science, and I did a doctorate in politics. And I did that because I was interested in political behavior, or interested in why people behave in the way that they do. And back in those days, I couldn't really do that studying neuroscience. We simply did not know enough about the brain at the time. So I kept following my, my interest in neuroscience. And then gradually, as fMRI scanners became available, began to write about it. And the result here is this book, which I suppose combines political science with neuroscience.
Can you briefly summarize the main ideas and the arguments in your book?
Main idea in the book is that we can actually read people's minds, and we can do that by so-called fMRI scans, which measures sort of blood flow in the brain. And if the blood flows particularly to one part of the brain, that's the part of the brain we're thinking with. So with these fMRI scans, we can identify a number of parts in the brain which characterize people who are conservative, people who are liberal, people who might be illiberal Democrats, to use a local term. So these sort of things we can identify when people are thinking. So using brain scans, we can predict people's behavior, we can predict how they vote, what political persuasions that they have, but we can also see the negative side of things, that people may sometimes be very agitated and use parts of the brain that we share with rats, cats, and bats that aren't the most sophisticated part. And sometimes when we get involved in political arguments and get very angry, we may use those parts of the brain. However, when we engage in policy discussions, when we try to find solutions to problems, we actually engage many parts of the brain. And that's what we're made for. We are the only species biologically that can learn from discussing things. Other species, even sort of, advanced primates, can't learn from talking to each other. So democracy is discussion, and we're the only species that have the ability to talk democratically because we have a brain that was evolved to solve problems through conversation. And when we scan brains, when people are engaged in policy discussions, we can see that many different parts of the brain actually get activated. And that's good for a thing called neuroplasticity, which means basically that many of the pathways of the brain are kept open. And there is some evidence to suggest that if you use many parts of the brain, if you develop this neuroplasticity, you are less likely to get Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and so on. So if we actually engage in proper, respectful, democratic discussion, then that's not only good for the body politic, for society, but it's also good for ourselves, for our well-being in later in life. All good things go together if we use our brains properly. However, often when we engage in politics in English, as opposed to perhaps other languages, we have a distinction between politics and policy. And politics is a rough and tumble where you have a political party. And typically when people are engaged in politics, they become very tribal, they become very angry, and they use a part of their brain called the amygdala. I mean, it's a very old part of the brain. Amygdala means almond in Latin because it's sort of vaguely almond-shaped. And that part of the brain is associated with fight and flight. So if I see a crocodile walking towards me, my amygdala would be activated. And the terrible thing really is that a lot of people, when they see the political opponents also activate the amygdala. They get that sort of fear and fight and flight kind of very angry feeling when they're just discussing politics as a tribal matter. So what we need to do is we need to move away from the winning the argument towards solving political problems. So hopefully the book will also sort of suggest that we're actually made for proper respectful discussions. That's how we're going to be more healthy. That's what our brains were designed for. And we shouldn't really revert to that sort of angry part of just shouting at each other, because literally that's the thing we should have overcome, you know, 400 million years ago or something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't really move us forward. It just keeps us in one place. I think one thing reading the book that stuck out at me is this: we can read people's brains. So I was just wondering if you could briefly explain which brain processes can be tracked, which specific parts of the brain are involved in these processes, and how this is actually done.
Yes, it can be done in many different ways. It really depends on what you're interested in. I suppose that's sort of pretty obvious. Now, it can be used in criminal trials. In India, for example, they have used slightly less sophisticated technology, but they've used brain scans to find out if people are lying. In sort of, you know, sort of police dramas, we know lie detectors or technology like that. But lie detectors are only efficient about 65% of the time. If we scan people's brains when they are lying, there are two parts of the brain that light up. There is the so-called ventrolateral prefrontal cortex. There's all these Latin terms. That is basically, ventro means sort of on the belly side of the brain, and lateral means to the side, and prefrontal cortex is sort of to the front. So it's sort of in the front side of the brain. That is an area which is associated with lying. We also have another part of the brain which is called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. That's sort of on the back of the brain, pretty much on top of it. And so sort of just above the forehead. And that part of the brain is associated with people sort of taking risks and being careful not to take risks. So when people are lying, we can see that they activate this ventrolateral prefrontal cortex, which is, if you like, you can't really say it's the lying center, but it's associated with lying. And then also people will be sort of thinking, I'm afraid I might get caught out, and so on. So you can identify parts of that is one example of a part of the brain you can identify with. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, this bit which is on the top of the brain, that is also associated often with people who vote for conservative parties. Typically, people who vote for conservative parties are a little bit skeptical. They're a little bit concerned about, you know, lifestyles. They may not be sort of the greatest fans of marriage equality, and they think people are woke and so on. And they may think that the government should be a little bit more careful. Basically, they are conservative. They're risk averse. And there's nothing particular, I mean, not intrinsically wrong with that. So people who are of a conservative persuasion tend to have that part of the brain more activated than others. Then we have a part of the brain called the insula. And for readers of the book, hopefully in the future, but for the listeners to the part of the podcast, they may know the Latin word insula, which means island. And there's a part of the brain which is on the side. So if you have a vague idea of what the brain looks like, there's sort of a on the brain, there's sort of the flap that goes out underneath the Sylvian fissure, it's called, that sort of that line that goes up. And underneath there, we have basically two layers of brain. And underneath there, we have the insula. And the insula is the part of the brain that is associated with empathy. It's also associated with things like you feel things are disgusting, that also gets activated. But if we just stick with the empathy bit, then people who tend to vote for parties on the left of the political spectrum, they tend to be a bit more perhaps interested in social issues. You know, socialist parties, I suppose, come from the idea that social issues are very important. You might feel that you feel sorry for people if they're poor and so on. So people who vote for the leftist parties, they tend to activate the insula, whereas conservatives tend to activate the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. So you can already there identify pretty much how people think when they see images when they're onto the brain scanner. So those are just sort of two examples of that. And if I can use an interesting example from some research that was done in China and in Australia, then they tried to see if you know, if people actually have empathy with other people. In China, they showed a video to people who were under the brain scanner, a video, or two videos, one where a Chinese person gets an injection and screams because supposedly it's very painful, and then a white person or a Caucasian person, and that person also screams. So these people in China who lived in rural areas, who'd never actually met Caucasian people, they then showed no sort of outward empathy towards the no activation of the insula in the case of the Caucasian person showing pain, but they showed it in the case of the Chinese person. So that would be, if you just think of the on the face of it, that would be, you know, quite a negative thing. People are, you know, only sort of predisposed towards their own kind and almost sort of racist in their beliefs, if you like. Now, what was then done in a follow-up study in Australia was a number of Chinese people then moved to Australia, and then they did in 5 years with an interval of 1 year, so one test every year, they tried to do the same experiment. And in the first year, the Chinese people who weren't used to living with Caucasian people also showed lack of sensitivity or lack of empathy with these people. But once they'd lived there for 5 years, they actually activated the insula in both cases. So when you start living with people of a different group, religion, and so on, you gradually realize that they are just normal people like me and you, and then you start having feelings of empathy towards them. And that is a, you know, people who are globalist will say that's a positive sign. But I suppose what is also interesting, sorry if I'm sort of banging on a little bit about this. So I find it very fascinating, being somebody who is a political scientist as well as somebody who has originally a background in brain science. I find it very interesting that we can actually identify what people think. We have in politics and in political marketing particularly, we have focus groups, and we do opinion surveys, and in the focus group we ask people what they think. And you can still do that. That is a valid way of doing things, but this can sort of double check, if you like, what people actually think. And people may not always be truthful in a focus group. So when we do brain scans of people and their opinions and so on, we can see what they really think. And that obviously, maybe that's sort of a bit of sort of swings both ways in a way, because the interesting thing there is that if you're a political party and you want to test if your candidate is a popular one, you can also use brain scans, and then you can test your messaging. A political party in Mexico called the Progressive Revolutionary Party, or PRI, actually used some of this technology way back in the 2012 election, at a time when they actually won the election. So there are already political parties, they don't like necessarily to admit to this, who are actually using this technology to test their messages. And some companies are already using this technology. Coca-Cola and McDonald's, for example, are using brain scans to identify the parts of the brain that get activated or not activated when they see a product. So we can sort of see the part of the brain that's called basal ganglia, which is another part of the brain that's associated sort of underneath the top layer of the brain, and that's associated with sort of Pavlovian responses, and you know, you show activation when you have the expectation of something happening. So you can use this just as a tool. That's what I do as a political scientist. I'm interested in why people behave the way that they do. But one of the things that we need to know about is that increasingly marketing people are using this technology. And I've always held the view that we need to understand issues in order to criticize them. And some people might be quite concerned that adverts and commercials are based on brain scans, and it's quite an intrusive thing. So I'm hoping that my book can also not just introduce this new field of social science, but also can make people realize there is such a thing, that we can actually read other people's minds. And I think that is a very new development. There was Cicero, who was a very famous Roman philosopher and statesman, said, "Our thoughts are private." And there's in German, there's an old folk song called "Die Gedanken sind frei," or "With Our Thoughts Can." This is sung in English by a guy called Pete Seeger. So, in this idea that at least our thoughts are private is no longer the case. And of course, that raises a number of prospects for also the types of government we may not particularly like, who might be totalitarian government. So, it's a double-edged sword. In some ways, it can help us to understand the brain and how it works, but it can also be abused. And the best way, I think, is always to let a bit of sunlight in so that people can determine whether they think this is a good idea or a bad idea.
Do you think we are entering the age of neuromarketing or...
I think we're already there. I think we just don't know about it. I don't know if you've been into a McDonald's restaurant lately. And I used to, a long time ago when I grew up, I'd go to McDonald's and there would always be this smell of French fries or chips. And now when I enter into a McDonald's, there's a sort of a smell of like a forest or... And then, I don't know if you've noticed, if you've gone to McDonald's, some people might have. And the reason for that is that McDonald's basically use brain technology to figure out how you'd be most likely to be hungry when you go into a McDonald's. And if you have that sort of feeling of sort of greasy French fries, you might think, oh, this is terribly unhealthy and I shouldn't have another one. And of course, that's not very conducive to you buying chips, as we call them in England, or French fries or frites, I think they call them in Belgium. I'm just trying to be international here. And then if you go in there, it's a smell of the forest, you sort of feel probably this is very good and I'm very healthy and out in the fresh air, then you are already being conned into thinking like that. And you're being conned because somebody has used brain scans technology. It's not as if you won't eat the French fries before, but it's probably just as well that you know about this. And it's probably just as well that you know that some political campaigns have used this technology. So people get terribly upset when they hear that they use focus groups and there's, AI thing that get algorithms sort of focus on the way you should vote and so on. So I think this is the new frontier. I think this is the, I think we're already in the era of neuromarketing. And I think it's better that we know about this, and not just neuromarketing in the commercial market, but also in the political market. There is a study that we cite in the book that shows that some of the effects of political marketing are three times as strong as the effects of, commercials for chocolate. So you can actually, you're more likely to be able to influence people's political behavior than you are to influence their consumer behavior. And we can see that through greater activation of parts of the brain when people see political commercials as opposed to when they see product commercials.
I wanted to pick up on what you said about through these fMRI scans, we can differentiate between liberal and conservative brains. It is often said that people become more conservative as they age. So do you think this is true? And what does this tell us about neuroscience?
We can, to a degree, say yes. I mean, there is that part of the brain that I mentioned, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is sort of like the skeptical part of the brain. And that has a tendency to become slightly more activated as people grow older. People who are very young don't really, are less likely to have that risk averseness. You've probably seen psychological studies, or you might know from sort of J.V. Lysette, especially young men sort of seem to have absolutely no fear and they feel completely invincible and very sort of likely to take risks. And taking risks is associated with not being on the right. So as you grow older, that part of the brain that is associated with conservative thinking probably grows older, but it grows more sort of pronounced. It's not as if everybody. I mean, there used to be a thing that if you're not left wing in your youth, it's you don't have a heart. But if you're not right wing at old age, you don't have a brain. And obviously, it's probably a person from the political right who's come up with that. So it's not quite like that. But people show slightly more small c conservative dispositions later in life, and the same part of the brain that is associated with that is also the one that is associated with less public spending and it could go terribly wrong. So there is that tendency. It is possible to a degree. I mean, not perfectly well to say there is the old brain that is a conservative brain, but there are elements that point in the direction of people becoming more risk averse, and people who are more risk averse tend to be more conservative. So it's not a straight sort of linear correlation, if you like, but there is that tendency, yes.
We already touched on this, but how do you think this neuroscientific approach is going to be used in the future? I mean, you already mentioned how it is used today in marketing, but also with focus groups. But what do you think the future for this approach is?
I think it's going to be sort of all of the above. I think it is what is interesting. The focus group was invented during the Second World War and by a guy called Robert Mertzen who worked on that. And then at that time, it was a relatively new thing. And then that only started really to be used in the 1990s when also opinion polls were used. So I think this will be a complementary tool, a way of understanding why people think in this particular way. And then based on, and this is probably where it becomes slightly more scary, and we need to know about it. When these scans have been done where people are seeing certain signs and certain things, then you will probably appeal to that. And the problem here is that one of the most greatest activation points is this amygdala that I talked about. It's very easy to appeal to sort of the hate part. And we fear is stronger than sort of rational thinking. And that for good evolutionary reason. If we were out in the savannah, 100,000 years ago and a lion was coming towards us, and it's obvious and it's natural and it's sensible that we run away or we pick up a stick and we start fighting the lion or whatever we do. So that overcomes us. But the problem is that in politics, we also need to think about policy. And policies aren't really the things that sort of activate us. We're more likely to be activated by the sort of fear things. And therefore, political campaigns will probably show that when people see people in Texas, for example, seeing photos of Mexicans coming over the border, then they've sort of been socialized to a degree into thinking that they're the enemy and they're awful people and so on. And then that sort of fear factor gets amplified by the brain, and then people will start using them in political commercials and so on. And so the danger with all of this is that political marketing will figure out that the thing that is that most appeal to us is these sort of fear things, and we're more likely to react to that than anything else. And therefore, in some ways, the brain scans are likely sort of to lead to a dumbing down of us and lead to a situation where we can see the things that really appeal to us are not the rational arguments about whether sometimes we should be cautious, which everybody agrees to a degree, and that we should sometimes be empathetic, but it's the other thing, the populist brain, the angry brain, that part of the brain that we again share with cats and rats. And in a way we know better, but the problem is that the people who are dealing with political advertising have found that the more emotional parts of the brain, the sort of more effect-oriented parts of the brain, are the ones that are most likely to cause us to react. So it might be, I mean, it's probably too far to say that this is just because of brain scans, because I don't think they are that widely used in Europe, but it would be a thing that could be a danger. And we see that political parties sometimes are using this sort of the fear factor, and that's on the left as well as on the right, to sort of drum up support. And the brain scans will probably suggest that is a most effective way. And that is a thing that we need to worry about. And we need to be alert to the fact that sometimes we see political commercials, we hear political statements, we hear political slogans that are intended to awaken that fear factor in us. And that would be supported by the brain scans. There was a study that we also cited in the book where there's sort of three types of brains. There's conservative brain, there's small c, if you like, progressive or left, center-left brains. And then there are also what we call the radical brain, where people get very, very angry and get into a frenzy. Obviously, we didn't have brain scans during the French Revolution, but when Marie Antoinette was being executed, we can be pretty sure, I think, that all the people there had very activated amygdalas when they saw that spectacle. And likewise, which is a thing we refer to in the book, when the people were storming the Capitol in America on the 6th of January, they probably weren't using the more advanced parts of the brain, but they were probably also quite amygdala driven. And it is dangerous on any number of levels when we get driven by that. But the fact of the matter is that those more, if you like, primitive or evolutionarily old part of the brains are the ones that sort of seem to trump, no pun intended, the other parts of the brain, especially when we don't think about politics all the time, because most of us, I think the average American thinks about politics 7 minutes every year consistently. It's been said anyway, I think it might be slightly more these days. But the problem is that is the part of the brain that then gets activated is probably the more angry, more primitive part of the brain, and not the sophisticated one that we alone as human beings have evolved.
In the book, you actually say that too much politics is not good for us.
Yes, no, I do. I mean, I say not too much politics is not good for us, but a lot of policy is very good for us. I think it's not good for us when we have the sort of partisan politics. The partisan politics, which is, I think, a point I also make in the book, partisan politics is about winning the argument, but policy is about solving the problems. And sometimes if we want to use our brains and when we are in discussions with people, we should probably start by saying, what is the actual problem we're trying to solve? Instead of just saying, well, I want to win the argument that you're an idiot and I know better than you do and all of that. That just leads to like a lazy part of the brain and not to our full perspective. But if you actually focus on policy, I want less politics and more policy. And if we can actually, every time we encounter somebody and we have a political discussion, then steer it towards saying, okay, what is the issue that we're trying to solve? And typically people will then have more nuanced views. And you'd sort of say, well, it's not about me being right and you being wrong. It's about trying to solve the problem. And when we then do that, then we activate the so-called Broca Center, which is the speaking center, because I will articulate my views and I'll be activating the Wernicke Center, which is sort of on the side of the head. And I'll be also activating elements of empathy. I'll be activating things about, you know, that's to do with can we afford it and so on. So all when we activate all these parts of the brain, we live up to our full potential, but only when we don't focus too much on politics and more on policy. So politics in itself, it's a necessity, but we should try to have politics done in a way that is more policy focused, because that ultimately will lead to a better society where we can all live, if you like, if not happily ever after, then at least peacefully with each other. And that fundamentally is the sort of the problem of sociology, is how can people even live together? Immanuel Kant, the great German philosopher, says that we have a social unsociability. We can't live without other people. We also can't stand them. And that's sort of like the problem that we often have, is that we're individualists, but we're also social beings. And our brain has that sort of funny thing about it. It's not necessarily ideally suited for living in societies, but we have a brain that is more or less evolved for us to be able to solve problems together, even if we don't necessarily get on with the people we're trying to solve the problems with. And on the positive side, neuropolitics identifies the areas of the brain that are associated with that get activated when people engage in these things. And I think as a social scientist, I find that very interesting, but also as a citizen, as a human being, if you like, I'm also aware of the dangers that it sort of throws up. And for that reason, I hope this book is one that introduces a very technical and specialized subject to ordinary fellow citizens.
What I really enjoyed in your book is that you also give a kind of solution to some of these problems, because in the last chapter, you're saying that what we should be doing is to listening to each other more. And I think that's quite missing from current political debate.
It is actually quite shocking how little we listen to people and how little we try to learn from people. And it's a lot of people who sort of do the talking, and then you have likes on Instagram by the people you support and so on. But it's more sort of like, you know, I have a right to express my opinion. And I think that fundamentally undermines us as really as human beings. And it sort of potentially makes us go backwards on the evolutionary ladder. There was an American anthropologist who once said that we are not what we know, but what we're willing to learn. And I think that is that the listening brain is the one we should really activate. So every time we talk to somebody, every time we encounter somebody, we should try to make it a policy or make it, not a policy, we should just try to make a habit of learning from somebody. So if you and I were just, you know, when you're now listening to me and I do all the talking, which is sort of like then you learn something. And but on a normal, this is an artificial discussion, but if we were meeting somebody, I sort of try to make a point of that every time I meet somebody new. I am willing to learn. I'm not what I know, but I am what I'm willing to learn. And what are you going to tell me today? What would I learn from you? And if you start treating people, my political views are probably fairly different from Donald Trump, say, and dare I say it might even differ from Viktor Orban, to get a local example. But nevertheless, and then that would be easy for me just to go in and say, oh, I disagree with these people and I don't want to listen to them. But if you then turn it around and say, you know, in my hypothetical meeting with Viktor Orban, what can you teach me today? What is it? What is your solution to problems? It's not about you winning the argument about whatever it is. What are the solutions you have? What can I learn from you? I'm willing to learn something. What can you teach me today? And by encountering people with that open spirit of being willing to learn, suddenly these people will be quite surprised, and they would sort of say, well, what would you mean? And then suddenly they feel that they're being taken seriously, and then the angry debate goes down, and people will start sort of engage actually in problem solving. So if you actually make it clear to people that you are there to learn from them, and equally, of course, they should probably be learning from you, but have that open mind and say every time you start a conversation, make it explicit you want to learn from somebody. When I'm talking to somebody who is very interested in her Instagram posts and her career as a rapper, and which is not really my sort of line of work, I'll be listening to how Instagram for rappers is going to make the world a better place, and or not, or whatever the case may be. Or you meet somebody who wants to tell you what the solution is to people driving too fast or whatever. But always try to steer issues onto what you can learn. We're not what we know, but we're willing to learn. And that is how our brains were designed. Our brains were not designed to fight. That's sort of more primitive species were designed to fight or flight. And if you're a cat, or if you're a rat or a bat or something, then that's how you're evolved. We, however, are evolved with a listening brain and a talking brain. We alone have the ability to listen and learn from that. And that ability that we have formed over millions of years through gradual evolution, that is a thing we should value, and we can only value that if we actually use our listening brain and learn from other people. And if we do that, I think we can dial down some of the anger in societies. We can make the societies safer, juster, more tolerant, perhaps, and we can also, as a positive byproduct of that, become slightly more healthy and be less likely to develop Parkinson's and all of that. So all of that is in a tiny little book that's published by Central European University Press.
Thank you, Matt, for joining us today. And thank you for this fascinating discussion. I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of the CEU Press podcast. We hope you found it informative and thought-provoking. And don't forget to check out The Political Brain, The Emergence of Neuropolitics, and other titles in the CEU Press Perspective series. Don't forget to subscribe and stay tuned for more engaging conversations to come. Thank you. Goodbye.